Before we get into today's episode, I want to invite you on a unique spiritual journey this Advent season. It's called Journey to Bethlehem, and it's a free 9-day text message series designed to prepare your heart for Christmas. Starting on December the 17th, and each day leading up to Christmas, you'll receive a short reflective message pointing you to the hope, peace, joy, and love found in the coming of Christ. It's completely free and a great way to keep your focus on Jesus this season. Sign up today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now here's today's podcast.
Before the rush takes over, start your Christmas journey with Premier's Advent Moments interactive calendar. Open each door and step into the unfolding story of Jesus with daily challenges rooted in kindness and a verse that brings you closer to Bethlehem. You'll also receive short emails of encouragement to help you stay centered through Advent. Sign up at premier.org.uk/advent2025. Brought to you by Sat7 UK. Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're really pleased to say we've got a guest on the show today, which is Rosalind Perkins. How are you, Rosalind?
I'm well, apart from a slight snuffly nose, but we're all good.
Excellent. Rosalind, would you mind kind of introducing yourself? How do you sum up who you are and what you do in a minute or so?
For sure. Thanks very much for having me on. It's great to meet and chat with you both. So yes, my name is Rosalind Perkins. I am a GP. I've been a GP in South London for 20 years. I am also a medical educator, so I teach young medical students from university in London, and they come to my practice every Friday and start off never having spoken to a patient, and by the end of the year they're essentially running the consultation. So it's a really great thing to be doing, and really enjoyable, and enjoy that a lot. And I'm also a pastor's wife. I've got three now adult children. I don't know what we call them. So we've become empty nesters in the last sort of year or so.
Fantastic. Well, we're really thrilled to have you on the show. In fact, we've been wanting to do this and speak to you for some time, because many, many months ago, regular listeners might remember we did an episode talking about natural family planning, kind of fertility tracking apps, and the kind of shift, a wave that some women are feeling around hormonal contraception. And following on from that, we had a really fascinating email from a listener called Janine who wrote in this. I was particularly struck by the argument that women don't want to take artificial hormones for 30 plus years of their lives. Now, as a woman in my 50s, I am confused by the enthusiastic support for hormone replacement therapy, HRT, in postmenopausal women. My own gynecologist has told me that women were, quote, never meant to live without estrogen, because until the modern era, we died soon after our childbearing years ended. As a Christian, I both believe that the body is good in how God designed it, and I'm challenged by the medical support for HRT in maintaining good health. And I saw that and I thought, do you know what? That is an absolutely fascinating question, but me and Dad are singularly ill-equipped to tackle that. So we're really thrilled to have Rosalind on to help us walk through this. Let's start off with some real basics. What is the menopause?
Great. So you're now going to get my patter that comes out to my patients. So the menopause is the last period you ever have, but you don't know it's your last period until you haven't had a period for a year. So you can only really diagnose menopause in retrospect, because there's this other thing called the perimenopause, which is the years around that time where your ovaries are still producing some hormones of your own, but in kind of bursts and not in a regular pattern. Thus, you get kind of spikes of hormone and then nothing. And so that then produces all these symptoms that people will be familiar with, the hot flushes, we can talk about the endless different symptoms that perimenopause can create. But and that can happen for a number of years around that time until the menopause, the time when your body's stopped producing estrogen, your body is not producing eggs, and your periods stop. So it can go up from just a few months to many years. And look, some people don't have any of those symptoms. Some people, their periods just stop, and that's the end of that, and they have no symptoms, and that's the end of it. So it's a very individual thing, with different women experiencing different degrees of issues or none.
And I think I'm right in saying that actually the menopause is very unusual amongst mammals, so that most mammals don't have a menopause, that in most species, females are capable of becoming pregnant all the way through until close to death. Whereas clearly there's something about being human that we stop the ability of having babies while still, you know, having potentially years ahead. I mean, I don't buy this idea that everybody just died previously. I think that's just wrong. And I think there are theories around, which I've heard, that menopause actually had some positive evolutionary benefit because it meant that the grandmother would stay, because childbirth was very risky. The menopause actually improved your chances of survival, and therefore likely that you would be around to order to support your children and your grandchildren.
I guess it is true to say that because we are living longer, women are living potentially a third or a half of their life after their menopause. That would be different from times of old. But yeah. And look, there are another couple of definitions right at the top. So there's early menopause. So that's somebody producing... Sorry, I should say the average age of menopause is 51. So stopping your periods, the average age is 51. This is certainly in UK figures. The early menopause would be having symptoms between 40 and 45. And then sadly, there's also what we used to call premature menopause. We now call it primary ovarian insufficiency. And that is when stopping your periods happens before the age of 40. And obviously that can have really devastating impacts for people in terms of fertility and hope to be parents and what have you. And then a slight subsection, surgical menopause. So that's when people may have had to have surgery to remove their uterus or their ovaries because of cancer, or they've had radiation to their pelvis or something like that, which obviously will induce a menopause at that point.
And let's also, while we're doing definitions, what is HRT and when did that first start to become an option for women?
So yes, hormone replacement therapy. Do you know what? I don't know when it first started being used. It's had a slightly checkered past. It's certainly in my lifetime as a GP, with people thinking it was wonderful. And then some studies came out that cast doubt on it, particularly a study in 2002, the Women's Health Initiative. That wasn't a very good study, actually, for lots of various reasons. They picked the wrong population, and they were using particular hormones that were not the best hormones. And so suddenly we were all not giving HRT again for a long, long time. And then that...
And the reason is because that it was associated with increased risk of cancer.
It was deemed to be risk, yeah. The levels of risk were deemed to be too high, but actually the quality of the study has now been slightly drawn into question, and so we're going on different studies, and the risk has been found to be not as high as that study suggested. So even as my time as GP in these 20 years, it has swung from being great, let's all be on HRT, to no, it's awful, to back now to actually the risks are not as high as we thought.
And how commonplace, how could you estimate, just back of the envelope guess, how many perimenopausal or postmenopausal women will be on HRT as a percentage of all women?
So,
and that's a very difficult question, I appreciate.
It is, but I mean, it is a very interesting question because it depends on perhaps who you're asking. So I had a patient last week who is of Muslim background, and I kind of explored this with her, and it wasn't something she was talking about with her friends and in her community. Whereas I talk to white middle-class people like me, and they're all talking about it all of the time. So that is going to bias the answer to that question, I suspect. So I think lots of people are taking it. I do. Mm-hmm. I think lots of people are taking it. We'll go into this. It isn't right for everybody. And it's all about, I think the take-home message is it has to be an individual discussion with your doctor about whether this is right for you. And obviously an individual decision on your part, having thought about it, prayed about it, talk to people that you trust and working out whether you feel this is right for you.
And do you end up in, just when you're talking to patients about this, I mean, just putting aside the kind of Christian and theoretical, do you end up with a sort of discussion of risks versus benefits, you know, that the benefits would be obvious in helping with menopausal symptoms, but on the other hand, there might be an increased risk of long term of cancer. That's the sort of discussion which goes on.
It is, and look, it's not a quick discussion, and it's often not a very easy discussion, because if you're not somebody that perhaps has grown up talking about stats, talking about risk, it's not necessarily an easy thing to grasp. The British Menopausal Society has some quite helpful infographics. So an infographic is a sort of pictorial representation of risk that certainly in the medical profession we use quite a lot to try and help people understand, you know, if you're on this medication for this long, this is how many more people are going to have this outcome, that sort of thing. And so those tools are quite useful to have. And often I'll send women away with, you know, stuff to read in their own time, just to sort of try and sit with it for a bit and see what. But that would definitely be part of the conversation, because it is not without any risk, and women need to know that. However, I think oftentimes they've heard that and perhaps will focus on that when the benefits to so much else and to the quality of life often far and away outweighs that small increase of risk in breast cancer or whatever else. Yeah.
And in ballpark figures, you know, in percentage of, if I was going to take this as a woman for, say, the next 10 years, what's my increased risk in percent of something bad happening?
So there is no increased risk that you will die. But there is a small increase of let's qualify that. It does need to be individualistic, because it depends what your own family history is, personal history, all the other things going on. And so that's why it's not a straightforward, quick conversation. But yes, the headlines would be the breast cancer is the one we all talk about. And it's a small increase of a small risk. And there are other lifestyle factors that would be much more important to be addressing, perhaps, in the first instance, over that. And there is also some evidence to suggest that it doesn't cause the breast cancer. The breast cancer was going to be there anyway, but it might cause it to grow such that it's then detectable. And I think people cleverer than me are still trying to work that out.
And isn't it also true that it could actually reduce the risk of some other kinds of cancer?
So, I mean, yes. And also, it slightly depends on what kind of HRT you're on. So that's another part of the conversation, because there's the estrogen, which we're replacing, that your body no longer produces. And then if you still have a womb, if you still have a uterus, you also need some progesterone, because unopposed estrogen will cause the lining of your womb to multiply, to thicken, and that can lead to other issues. So there are two hormones often going on here. If you have had a hysterectomy, if you no longer have a womb, then you only take the estrogen. And the risk profiles for estrogen only and combined estrogen and progesterone are slightly different in slightly different cancers. So yeah. So again, we're back to individual conversation with your doctor about slightly complicated things, but certainly worth having the conversation.
And again, it's a slightly going off as a tangent, but it's something that, you know, in my area as a paediatrician, I've had many, many of these kind of conversations, not about HRT, but about other things to do with children. And it is this problem of how you communicate rare risks. I mean, in my case, I was often trying to communicate very, very rare risks, like problems of vaccination. And it's almost like we don't have just as human beings, we don't have a good way of getting our heads round these kind of risks. We have a way of understanding something's really quite likely, like it might rain today. And we have a way of understanding that something's really incredibly rare, like I might get run over and die. But once you put a risk somewhere between those two extremes, I don't know what it means. What does a 1 in 50 risk of an increase in cancer, is 1 in 50 important? Is it unimportant?
I know, and I think that's perhaps this, is that the skill of the clinician or whoever it is that's having this conversation to try and help the person? Because like you say, if this is not the world you live in or the way you think, is that a big risk or not? Which is why I think these pictorial representations where they have, you know, lots of little people along and you add an extra one in can be really helpful. But going back to the lifestyle stuff, things like smoking and drinking and obesity are going to be increasing your risk so very much more than being on HRT. And those are things that are not hormonal. You know, the treatment of those things is not hormonal. And that's why in any conversation about treatment for menopause, we will go to the lifestyle stuff first and look at the woman as a whole and look at her risk of cardiovascular disease, all of that, bone health, all of that. So we would start there. It's interesting to me that we, just using that word treatment of menopause, I was thinking about this the other day, we talk about diagnosing menopause, but we don't diagnose puberty, and it is a natural occurrence in a woman's life. So I don't know whether we need to have a conversation about renaming it. I don't know.
Do you think it's become excessively medicalized? Because now HRT is an option. Everyone feels like, well, if the clever egghead scientists have created this drug I can take, then it probably means it is a problem that needs treating. Whereas, as you say, 100 years ago, there was nothing you could do. No. Women just went through the menopause and just got on with it.
Exactly. And they did, didn't they? So we know that, you know, it was different times then and people perhaps were more stoical, got on with it, didn't say anything. Life was harder in different ways. So you didn't have the headspace or the bandwidth to be thinking about these things. But in the current times, if we do and we know about it and it's helpful and we've applied due process and thoughtfulness, how is it different from other medical interventions that we would advise or take for ourselves that are going to improve the symptoms that we feel and be good for us in terms of longevity and avoiding chronic disease and so on? So, potentially. It's interesting to me where people go looking for their healthcare. So there's a big industry in the private health sector for, you know, menopause specialists, and they're really not doing a whole lot different than the GPs are. Of course, we all need to be trained and better at it, and some of it is about time. And if you have longer to talk about it in a half-hour appointment with a private practitioner, you may feel better heard. Whereas, of course, in good old NHS, we'd have less time than that. But it does, I mean, I would give my ladies often 2 or 3 chats about it and send them off to think about it and come back.
And what about this? We're very aware of this trend towards wellness. I mean, it was mentioned by the question, wasn't it, that just putting in these artificial chemicals into my body, I mean, it can't be right. It must be... You know, I'm becoming a product of the sort of the pharmaceutical industry and all those weird, horrible things. You know, surely I should just keep my body free from all of that.
So look, interesting. There have been developments in the hormones over the years, and there's this big thing about bioidentical. Now look, the hormones that we give currently are molecularly the same as our own hormones. They're obviously made in a factory somewhere, but they're not synthetic. And so they are the same as the estrogen and the progesterone that our bodies produce. Again, in the past, the progesterones were more tricky, and it was about making something that that could be absorbed into the body and made useful to the body. But there's the latest generation is called utrogestan, which is a micronized estrogen that is absorbed well and put to use in the body. And that, again, it's my understanding is molecularly the same as your own hormones. So you could argue they're not, you know, they're not artificial. And the mode of transport is much better than it used to be. So it used to be that it was tablets that people took. And we've discovered that transdermal application of estrogen reduces the risk of the breast cancer, reduces lots of risks. So most practitioners now would prescribe either patches or gels or sprays for the estrogen element of the HRT. And then the progesterone, that is a tablet, but that that can be taken orally. Or the other thing that's very popular would be a Mirena coil. So that's a coil that has progesterone implanted in it that then gets released into the body. Now, that's a whole other conversation about the coil, because, of course, there are elements of it's also used for contraception. And for lots of people, that's a very neat way to have contraception in later life and to have your progesterone part of your HRT. But we know too, don't we, that there are ethical issues around the use of coils, which is perhaps another conversation.
And what do you make of this idea that in our listener Janine's question, or a gynecologist said, you know, women were never meant to live without estrogen because women died after our childbearing years ended. That's probably not the case, but it's certainly the case that life expectancy has increased significantly in the last kind of 100, 150 years. And the period of time that humans were, quote, meant to live, women were meant to live without estrogen might have been 5 or 10 years when women died in their 60s or 70s. And now if you live into your 90s or sometimes even into your 100s, you could easily go 30, maybe 40 years post-menopause. Does that change how we feel about introducing estrogen, even if it is completely bioidentical to the estrogen our bodies would produce? Human beings didn't normally have any estrogen in their bodies when women hit 100 years old.
I think it's a certainly a good question. And look, we're not proposing that our 100-year-olds take HRT. So you have an annual review when you're HRT, and all the time you're looking at benefits against risks. And as you get older, the risk of breast cancer, the risk of, you know, other things will change. And so I've got a few of my patients in their 60s, but we have to have a careful conversation, 60s and 70s, careful conversation about benefits and risk. But returning to your question, so I understand where the question's coming from. Are we going in circles around the Lord's will and the way he's made bodies and
deviating from the order of creation.
Better way to put it. But we could say that about lots of things in medicine, couldn't we? You know, and we're, you know, statins to reduce cholesterol. You could say there weren't statins before, so we shouldn't be using statins because, you know, but and you know, taken to the nth degree, you could say that about all of medicine. What we are using God-given advances in knowledge and skills to help people live a more healthy, longer, useful life in his service, if you're a Christian. And so if there is something that's not ethically questionable and you go into it, as I said before, thoughtfully and prayerfully, taking good counsel, for me, I don't think there's a reason not to do it. I guess behind that, you should also say, well, why are you taking it? And I think people realise people are not just taking it to look youthful and be you know, look younger. Most people are taking it because they're fed up of waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning with hot flushes and their head's been completely foggy and them being more anxious than they used to be and not having the confidence in their decision-making as they used to be. That's why most people are taking it. And if you are able to just function better, to be able to serve your family and do your job better, serve in a church setting better, is that not a good reason to take it? You know, if you're less likely to break your hip because you've been taking HRT, isn't that a good reason to take? So I don't think, and I don't know that that's what your questioner is asking about, but it's not about just looking, you know, your hair being glossy and your skin being better. That's not, we're not trying to be youthful, I don't think, whoever's taking the HRT. And yeah, you're not taking it forever. You're taking it for a time, and it's just helping you function.
As we near the end of the year, I want to pause and thank God for how he's worked through Premier Insight in 2025. From honest conversations on Unbelievable to the wisdom of N.T. Wright, this ministry has helped thousands grow in faith, defend truth, and engage culture with grace. But none of this happens without you. Right now, Premier Insight faces a $106,497 funding gap that must be closed by December the 31st. And thanks to a generous $25,000 challenge grant, your gift today will go even further to equip believers and reach seekers in 2026. Visit premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. And now, back to today's episode.
Before the rush takes over, start your Christmas journey with Premier's Advent Moments interactive calendar. Open each door and step into the unfolding story of Jesus with daily challenges rooted in kindness and a verse that brings you closer to Bethlehem. You'll also receive short emails of encouragement to help you stay centered through Advent. Sign up at premier.org.uk/advent2025. Brought to you by Sat7 UK. You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
It's really interesting because from an ethical point of view, a framework that I've often used, and we've talked about in this podcast before, is between thinking about interventions which are fundamentally restorative, aiming at restoring the body as it was meant to be, and interventions which are fundamentally enhancing, which are changing the design in some way. And I'm just thinking that actually in some ways HRT comes quite neatly between those two ways, you know, and part of the discussion then is this restorative? Is this basically putting back human bodies to where God always intended? And certainly when you look at things like the symptoms you've described, I mean, wanting to get rid of those symptoms is not a question of enhancing. It's not saying, no, you know, I want to be superhuman. It's just I want to function normally and I don't want to have a hip fracture and I don't want to, you know, is that wrong? But then you can see the other side that, and certainly perhaps going on indefinitely and saying, you know, because I have heard of people in their 80s taking it, you know, I think it's quite trendy in the States for some people, you know, so and there it becomes a question, you know, is this really, is it moving into changing the design? I don't know. I'm fascinated by the question.
I don't know, you've come across, there's a book by a British author called Rachel Jones called, it's called A Brief Theology of Periods. I don't know if you've come across it.
I've heard of it, yeah.
Great little book. And she's got one chapter on menopause and she uses this quote that I really like. It says, our timepiece, and by that she means our uterus, our timepiece is a blessing if it tells us the truth that we'd often rather avoid. We're all aging, more to the point, we're all dying. Our womb may shut up shop first, but one day so will our bodies. And I think that's really interesting because it's a real sort of visceral reminder, isn't it, that we're not here forever. And if we have faith, we believe that what we're going on to is so much better than here. And the men don't have that. So I think there's a lot, and there's a whole heap of change in a woman's life at this stage anyway, isn't she? She might be caught in the middle of caring for elderly parents, trying to cope with adolescent children who then move into young adult children. And there's the work scenario. There's all of this stuff going on, and they're often carers. So there's lots going on. And then this happens and it's like, hold on a minute, we aren't here forever. And I think that's actually a kindness of God that it reminds us that it's not all about that. And I guess in answer to your question, John, are we trying to pretend that's not the case? Are we pushing it back? So I think it's a good question.
Yeah, and actually, you know, to be honest, I speak as a mere man here, it isn't quite true that we don't have the same thing. It's not so obvious.
No,
okay. Biologically, but yeah. The truth is a lot of men around the same kind of age, you know, close to home, are very aware also of their sort of changing bodies, of, you know, changing sexuality and sexual functions, of awareness of loss of athletic ability. So our bodies are telling us that we're growing up.
The cliff situation.
It isn't quite so dramatic, but it's nonetheless, it's there. And part of growing old, there is an accepting part. And as you say, you know, I've sometimes tried to argue that we should start a Christian campaign, which is Wear Your Wrinkles with Pride. You know, so rather than constantly trying to look 25 and trying to behave as though I'm 25, I should actually be proud of the fact that I am, you know, from the Bible, you know, your grey hairs and your wrinkles and all that is evidence of God's faithfulness. It shows that God has been with you over a long life. And rather than try and hide all that evidence, I should instead say, I'm grateful for this evidence of God's faithfulness to me over a long life.
And that puts me in mind of the woman in Proverbs 31. She's not praised for how she looks. She's praised that she fears the Lord, and she's doing all these different bits and pieces in the workplace and in her family. But it's nothing about what she looks like. And so I agree with you. I think, and we're responding, aren't we, to a lot of what society is telling us about what is valuable. So there's a space there for a conversation about, should we dye our hair? Should we, you know, what about surgical treatments? All of that stuff.
Yeah.
Is about look, whereas HRT is less about that, more about I want to function and I want to make sure if I fall over I don't break my hip.
I think that's a really useful distinction, isn't it? Because there is a lot of pressure, particularly on women, but I think it's spilling over to men now, to kind of resist the effects of aging and the normalization of things like cosmetic surgeries, you know, the $1 billion anti-aging cream industry, all of these things. There is a heap of pressure from society that tells women as they get into their 50s and 60s, you need to stop this aging process. You are bad for aging completely naturally, the way that humans have always aged. But that is, as you say, very different to a medical treatment which says aging is normal, but what is not the creator's design is, as you say, women falling over and fracturing their hips or being unable to sleep because of hot flushes or, you know, anxiety and brain fog and things like that. You know, there are lots of people, particularly I think in the States, kind of experimenting with using hormones later in life. I mean, there's a big movement among men taking testosterone in large doses as it kind of, you know, supersizes your allegedly your masculine powers, you know, even in your 20s or 30s. That feels to me an attempt to use hormones as an enhancer to turn yourself into some kind of superhuman, but clearly replacing estrogen and progesterone as your body stops producing it naturally to prevent some of those more kind of distressing symptoms. It feels like quite a different case.
And just on that, you've reminded me, I haven't actually mentioned testosterone. Testosterone is a hormone that is given to women also. So women produce a small amount of testosterone naturally. And there's a big area around giving testosterone supplements to women as well. Mostly it's the indication is loss of libido. And certainly if we're going by the NICE guidelines, National Institute of Care Excellence, you're only meant to prescribe it if you're a menopause specialist or you've had additional training in menopause treatment. And the idea is that you've maximised the estrogen level. And if there's still an issue around libido, then that's something that can be looked at. But again, other providers would be much quicker, I think, to prescribe that. And then a fourth area, which I've also missed talking about, was topical estrogen, just for those, just for the issues around urogenital issues. So things like dryness and recurrent urinary tract infections, and so people there, your doctor can prescribe a topical estrogen to be put vaginally, which can help with sexual function and sort of urogenital issues, urinary infections and so on, and that's completely safe. So that's fair. So you can be on that without being on systemic HRT that you're rubbing into your skin.
And there's one other thing as well that often crosses my mind in this conversation, you know, the idea that women should just kind of tough it out and, you know, your forebears and your grandmothers manage without HRT. Why are women so weak? There's actually a long, quite misogynistic history in medicine, isn't there, of women's pain and women's suffering being overlooked by what was previously a kind of male-dominated medical establishment. And that's, you see that in things like PCOS or endometriosis and other kind of areas where there's just way less research, way less funding, way less interest because it's female suffering. And I think sometimes, is there an edge of that in this idea that you can just grit your teeth and tough out the menopause? Why are women complaining so much?
I think you might be right. And look, we're still way back on that. So I work in an area of London where throw in a few more other societal differentials, ethnicity, differentials in economic status, all of that feeds into who can access help and how the establishment views that request for help. And there's some good stuff out there trying to address that imbalance, but we're not there yet.
Yeah, I'm afraid there's really very good scientific evidence, isn't there, that doctors in particular, well, doctors and nurses, tend to underestimate pain symptoms in women, in people of colour, in people of different ethnicity and so on. So if you're white and male and you say you're in pain, you're likely to be treated seriously and sadly, you know, if you're come into the other categories, and which is, you know, I can't think it's absolutely outrageous. And yet, you know, the evidence is it's still there in our lovely NHS.
Well, let's moving on from HRT. The menopause is obviously that something that will affect every woman in her life, and women make up more than half of those in churches. Are there things that you think churches should be doing or being aware of about how they can help their perimenopausal kind of members walk through that journey better?
Yeah. So look, I think it's interesting. There aren't very many Christian books out there that are massively helpful, or they just don't exist. But the tide is starting to turn, and there's starting to be conversations or talks or women's breakfasts just to raise awareness, to think about it from a Christian perspective. And it's things. So I, when I talk about it, I talk about it in terms of loss. So it's a loss of femininity. It's a loss of fertility, primarily. It's the loss of the role of motherhood, perhaps. And it's a loss of competency. That's the one that I've really struggled with. I like to think of myself as competent, and suddenly I'm doing daft things and saying things that don't make sense. And a lot of it is about idols. So I potentially idolize being competent. You know, that has become too important to me. And so when that is threatened or exposed, I don't like that. And we know that idolatry is not a good thing. It doesn't please God. So we need to talk about these things. And I think stop pretending that it's all fine when actually there's sin in amongst all of that. And you can't blame it on your hormones. I'm sorry I shouted at you, it was my hormone. You know, we are all responsible for our reactions to what is going on around us. And we need to have a humility about that. And I think so in terms of in churches, I think talking about it, and that is starting to happen. And, you know, the Bible doesn't, obviously, if you look in a concordance, you're not going to find the word menopause. But as you both alluded to, that the Bible has lots to say about getting older. And I think we need to be, you know, the stuff in Titus about older women teaching younger women, we need to be talking about this and raising it as a thing so that people are thinking about it even as they're growing up, or thinking about it in relation to their mothers or their aunts or their older sisters and so on. And this idea again about our body is decaying, we know that. We're not, you know, we're going on to what is so much better, but how can we use the time that we've got here? And as we said, you're at this stage in life, in your 50s and 60s, your responsibilities are changing, and it may be that you have more time maybe to draw alongside younger women, to mentor them, to read the Bible with them. You know, it may be that you've got capacity to serve in church in a way you didn't, you know. And we can all think of older women that are just like gold dust. You know, they're such godly saints, and they have time to pray. They have experience in life that they may not feel that. You become that older woman slightly before you think you are, often, I think. But then realizing that you're put in the body of Christ to serve the body of Christ. And so using those opportunities that this time of life might afford you to work for others and in his service.
Absolutely. In fact, I've often reflected on the fact, you know, in the history of the church going back 2,000 years, there have been these traditions of amazing older women, you know, who are often described as mothers of the church. And who played a unique role, you know, and people used to beat a path to their door to go and receive from their wisdom and so on. And it seems to me really sad that, you know, maybe conservative evangelicalism has really lost that. It's been so focused on sort of male headship and so on that it's lost this vision for the mothers of the church and that motherly role.
Exactly. Yes, I agree.
Mm-hmm. Can I just put another thing past you? And that is, I'm quite interested in the scriptures when it talks about beauty, and particularly talking to women. And it doesn't say, it seems to me, you know, don't worry about beauty. It's not important at all. Just serve Jesus. Actually, what it says is, yes, being beautiful is really important, but seek an inner beauty. You know, it's all about what you define as beauty. It's not that beauty is wrong. It's what you define as beautiful. I mean, is that fair? Do you think there's something in that?
So, I think so. And there's that Gnostic heresy, isn't there, about the fact that bodies don't matter. They do matter, but they're not what it's all about. And you can see it, can't you, in people that you come across, that inner beauty, the quiet and gentle spirit. And again, that needs to be a little bit unpacked. We don't all have to be completely quiet. But it's about a respectfulness and caring about what's important. And you see it, don't you? When you meet Absolutely. Women like that, you know it. And for me, I want to be like them. You know, I've got a few people I know, and I think, if you said to me in 20 years' time, you'd become like such and such, I would just think, well, there we go. That's a 20 years well spent. And it's not about the fact that she looks like she's 40. You know, it's about the love and the care and the concern and the consideration and the godliness. You know, it's about knowing the Lord Jesus and living your life for him in the setting in which he's put you.
I can totally get that. And in fact, it just made me think of when I was in my early teens, 14, 15, there was this wonderful old lady who was called Auntie Jane, who was a single lady living in this tiny little bedsit, which always used to smell a bit of gas, you know, when you went there. And yet every time you went, and people did, I mean, the young people went to go and see her because there was just something about her. And she would always say, I'm so grateful for this place that God has given me. And she just, it was like the Lord Jesus just came out of her. And, you know, that made a big impact on me. And I know a lot of other young people, there was just something about that. And of course, this is for the men as well. I mean, you know, I think, you know, if I could end up like a godly old man, as opposed to being some sort of arrogant, self-opinionated or, you know, misogynistic or prejudiced, or you know, if it's possible to end up as a Christ-like godly old man, then you know, what better way would there be to end your life?
Yeah, agreed.
I think every church I've ever been a part of has that kind of core of mostly women, but not just, but of kind of older members who are absolutely central to the prayer ministry, to the pastoral team. They go on visits, you know, they are welcomers at the door.
Yeah.
They're there at every church meeting, every prayer meeting. And It's easy to overlook them because, you know, the leadership is all these thrusting people in their 30s and 40s getting stuff done. But actually, none of it is possible without the faithfulness of those older saints and their kind of commitment. And I think it's really healthy to talk about that and to kind of honor our elders in the faith as well as literal elders as well. And going back to that original question, I think I don't think I've ever heard the word menopause come out of someone's mouth at the pulpit in a church. And that's probably bad, right? That's probably not great. This is an experience that many, many people in churches are having. And you want, it doesn't have to be a sermon on the menopause, but like you want it to be in the conversation. It's not a shameful secret. It's not something dark and disgusting. This is a part of life that half the congregation go through. And you want that to be talked about just completely openly and naturally because Jesus has something to say about that.
Yeah, I have yet to have a man come to one of my talks, but
oh shame.
But maybe I should push for it because I think, you know, I remember raising it with my two sons and my husband and sitting them down and explaining why mum was slightly losing her marbles. And of course they absolutely hated it. They were so awkward. And I hate it too, because I, again, going back to that competence thing, I don't want them daft. But it happens. And so I think it's incumbent probably on the women to engage the men about it, their own men, and then perhaps other people's men as well. But you're right, we are the body of Christ and we need to help one another through different seasons of life. And if we're not talking about it, that's not going to happen, is it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm one of three sons and obviously grew up fairly ignorant about, you know, women's health and women's issues. And I actually think it was brilliant that for some reason, when I was at school doing GCSE biology, we did a whole half term on periods and menstruation. And we were all, you know, boys and girls together at a mixed school, all taught, this is how, you know, female bodies work. This is how the various hormones. And obviously, when you grow up to become, I'm now a husband and the father to a daughter, I'm really pleased. I can't, like, you know, put my fingers in my ears and say, oh, it's all so icky and disgusting. Like, no. This is that attitude you still find in some men today who just don't want to, that's women's issues, not my concern, don't want to go there. And that's just not good. I just don't think that's good enough, even if I wasn't a husband and a father to a girl.
Yeah, I agree.
Just before we finish, and it's been a really fascinating talk, could we just go and talk about contraception? And because, you know, this is partly where we came in and thinking about the fact that, you know, I'm quite interested in the history of contraception. You know, when the combined contraceptive pill first came in, it caused a lot of controversy, especially among Christians. A lot of Christians were deeply opposed. You know, it was associated with sexual promiscuity. It was foreign chemicals and so on. And then it gradually sort of, you know, became accepted and became very commonplace and very usual for Christians to be using hormonal contraception and so on. And now there seems to be a move again to question this and to say, not just within the Christian world, where the whole move towards natural fertility seems to be, you know, increasing, but also I think in the secular world, where many young women are just saying, you know, I don't want to have anything to do with it, and there are suggestions that this is actually contributing to the rise in abortion and so on. Have you come across this much? I mean, what's your perspective?
Yeah, I think in my everyday practice, I would echo that. I think more often I'm, you know, when I'm talking to young women, I'll ask them about contraception and they'll say, oh, no, I'm not using anything. And sometimes they might be using condoms rather than hormones. And sometimes they're really not using anything at all. And try and have that conversation about what the inevitable consequences might be if there be pregnancy. And they seem to be quite relaxed about that. So I think what you've proposed as a shift in sort of practice is probably true. I mean, I haven't looked into it in terms of stats or anything. Yeah, you're right, both in Christian and non-Christian circles, I think people are moving away from it. And I guess it goes back to that motivation. Why are you taking it? What's it about? And we're back again, aren't we, to talking about risk and how we would discuss with the general population about risks of taking medicines and what does it actually mean, and is your increased risk of thrombosis being on a hormonal contraception, in real terms, what does that actually mean for you with your background and your predispositions and whatever, and the risk of pregnancy. But
as the resident young person, when I have come across this trend among, you know, younger women still who are, you know, pre-menopause, who are still very much fertile, who are drifting away from hormonal contraception, I observe and hear saying it's less about those kind of hyper rare supposed risks around thrombosis or cancer. And it's more about saying, you know, I went on the pill as a 13-year-old, all my friends did, and we just thought it was just, we had to accept the fact that it has this aura of side effects, whether that might be, you know, mental health things around anxiety, or whether it might be other more physical stuff. And now none of them are kind of life-threatening, deadly, but I increasingly come across women who say, do you know what, I'm just not prepared to live like that anymore. I don't think it's the price you have to pay, or the price my body seems to pay to be on the pill is no longer worth it, in a way that I think would be quite strange for their mothers and grandmothers who first went on the pill, because it was this revolutionary thing that suddenly freed you from the anxiety that had hung over every woman, you know, for generations. And I think today's women are so divorced from that, and they're so kind of in that post-abortion, post-accidental pregnancy world, that actually the kind of what their parents would have said, well, yeah, it has these some unpleasant side effects, but that's a small price to pay. Women saying, actually, no, that's too high a price to pay. Is that something that resonates at all with your experience?
I think so. I think it does. But I guess then the conversation is around the pregnancy thing and what would you do if that were to happen? And and we're back at an impasse potentially for where the start of life happens and what your ethics and your beliefs are around that.
I mean, it is interesting again, because taking a sort of historical perspective, I know that public health doctors, I mean, I was taught it repeatedly as a junior doctor, that basically once we make a universal contraception available to the population and we make sex education universally available across the population, we will find that unplanned pregnancy will become almost non-existent because it's obvious, you know, and yet here we are with universal contraception and universal sex education, and lo and behold, abortion rates continue to rise. And I think from a public health perspective, doctors are astonished by that reality, and yet here we are.
And we as Christians might feel, many of us will feel, that abortion is never the right solution to an unplanned pregnancy. But I think you don't even have to believe that life begins at conception to say, hang on, ditching contraception in favour of repeated rounds of pregnancy followed by elective abortion is not a wise, healthy way to live, even if you don't have moral qualms. Like, that's not a win, even if it's technically possible to live like that.
I think people do live like that. They think that's acceptable. So whether down the line there'll be outcomes that push it back the other way, I don't know.
Well, and I think it's all related to this relentless propaganda that abortion is a completely normal, natural woman's right, that it's no interest to the doctors, it's just, you know, entirely... just part of normal existence, which amazingly is being supported by the RCOG, the Royal College of GPs, the medical profession, certainly a significant group of it seems to be supporting this agenda that abortion is consequence free almost. And I suspect that there will be a real turnaround in the future, because it's just transparently wrong, even at a medical level. You know, the idea that you can destroy a pregnancy at any stage and that it has no medical consequences or psychological consequences or relational consequences, I mean, it really beggars belief. And I suspect that there's going to be some kind of backlash, and I wonder even whether there's going to be a kind of Me Too movement when people start being honest about the consequences of having repeated abortions and so on.
Well, shall we draw our conversation to a close there? We've covered a lot of ground. Thank you so much, Rosalind. It's been really, really helpful talking through some of these issues medically and kind of from a Christian perspective. Just before we end, is there any books or resources for Christians who want to think more about menopause that you'd recommend?
Yeah, so as I say, there's not loads of them. So there's a book by Sarah Allen called Pause. And in that, she has sort of little vignettes of women and scenarios that they may be facing. And then thoughts about how to approach it with a Christian perspective. So it's sort of quite descriptive, helpful. There's one that I find quite useful is, I'm just looking for my... it's called Identity Crisis, Identity Theft, sorry, edited by Melissa Kruger. And I think we haven't touched on this much, but a lot of the menopause stuff is identity. Who am I? You know, I used to be confident, now I'm not. I used to be a mum and now my kids have left. Well, who does that make me? And just that is exploring who am I in Christ? You know, I'm his child, I'm beloved. All of that, so that it just reframes how you're feeling about who you are and where your value comes from. There's another book by Paul David Tripp called Lost in the Middle, which is it's not about menopause necessarily, but it's about this time of life. So it's both for men and women. And then in terms of sort of secular stuff, the British Menopause Society is worth looking at, and they've got a sort of resource that's more patient focused rather than professional focused called Menopause Matters, and another website called Rock My Menopause. So that's more around just information giving, and those infographics that I was talking about around risk, found through those as well.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much. We'll try and include some links to those in the show notes for people who want to read more about that. But thank you again, Rosalind. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And also to Janine, our listener, who sent in that brilliant question that inspired this conversation. We love to hear what you thought of this conversation or what questions it prompted for you. So please do get in touch with us. You can email molad@premier.org.uk. There's also lots of other material on Dad's website if you're interested in reading more around medical ethics in particular. That's johnwyatt.com. And you can find some of my journalism on my website, tswyatt.com. And in particular, I'd encourage you to sign up to my weekly Substack newsletter, The Critical Friend. That's it for everyone. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable. Before the rush takes over, start your Christmas journey with Premier's Advent Moments interactive calendar. Open each door and step into the unfolding story of Jesus with daily challenges rooted in kindness and a verse that brings you closer to Bethlehem. You'll also receive short emails of encouragement to help you stay centered through Advent. Sign up at premier.org.uk/Advent 2025. Brought to you by Sat7 UK.